Hello, this is Rita Schulte with the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette from Thursday, April 11th, 2019. We'll begin on page one with an article with the headline "Special Meeting Set to Discuss the Yards. Board Vote Expected on This Part of the Project." The Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District is poised to take another step forward on the Yards, the mega development being planned for the eastern edge of downtown Champaign. The MTD board will hold an extra meeting Monday to discuss the details. The board will be asked to say yes to the scope of the MTD's share of this project, which would include covering $25 million of the $200 million plus overall cost. "This is all we're going to be talking about at this meeting," said MTD Managing Director Carl Knott. "This just to get this out and move the ball forward in a real productive manner." The Yards is being undertaken as a partnership between the MTD, City of Champaign, and private developers. And so far, that includes plans to expand the MTD's Illinois Terminal building and to add new retail and office space, apartments, a hotel, and athletic arena. The MTD already took a step forward by signing a contract with a consultant last month to get its part of the project through the pre-construction phase. The MTD share will include an expansion and renovation of the terminal, an expansion of bus platforms, and coverage of part of the cost of a mixed-use facility with parking, retail, and commercial space. Another 24,248 square feet would be added to the approximately 50,000 square foot terminal building, which would remain four stories and expand to the south, Knott said. Some additional details of the Yards plans include 1,128 new parking spaces, 179 residential units, 116,490 square feet of office and retail space, a 180-room hotel, a 29,240 square foot convention center, and a 291,958 square foot arena. The MTD won't be footing any of the apartments, hotel, convention center, and arena expenses. The MTD hopes to cover its entire $25 million investment with a federal grant funding. The Transit District wants to share in the development of the office and retail space because it stands to reap part of the rental income, Knott said. In fact, rents on leasable space in the current Illinois Terminal building are already covering the cost of operating that facility, he said. "The community gets a great facility and it doesn't increase our operating expenses," Knott said. The MTD anticipates entering into an agreement with the private developer Core Spaces and also receiving a decision on federal grant money this year. Construction is expected to start next year and run through 2023, according to the MTD. In another article on page five, headlined "Five Area Solar Farms Wind Energy Credits," Tracy Crane writes, "Only five area community solar projects were big winners in Wednesday's Illinois Power Agency lottery in Chicago, where about 10% of the nearly 1,000 proposals snagged the renewable energy credits made possible by the Future Energy Jobs Act. In the larger community category, mostly 2 megawatt projects that will generate electricity Illinoisans likely can buy through subscriptions, only one Champaign County project was chosen. A 2 megawatt farm proposed by Forefront Power near Sydney. According to Power Agency Director Anthony Starr, 2 megawatt solar farms make enough electricity to power about 1,500 to 2,000 homes and typically use about 15 to 20 acres of land. Community solar projects provide access to solar power to residents who can't put arrays on their roofs. Also making the cut on Wednesday were 3 community solar projects in Vermilion County, one in a field outside Ridge Farm, another at the former GM Foundry site in Tilton, and a third in a field near the Danville Correctional Center, as well as one in Iroquois County on the outskirts of Watsika's southwest side. Not a part of the power agency's lottery were another 740 large distribution generation projects that were also awarded. These projects, which generally consist of smaller arrays at businesses or homes, do not connect directly to the power grid and offer subscriptions. Instead, Starr said, they are designed to offset electricity use where they are located, like the one at Monticello Middle School, one of about 70 approved in Champaign and surrounding counties. Superintendent Vic Zimmerman called the proposed 840-kilowatt project on a 4.9-acre grassy area behind the middle school a behind-the-meter solar array. The energy that is gathered from the solar panels will go right into the school and be used, he said. The tax credits, he said, will not benefit the district, but instead its vendor, Clean Energy Design, which will build the solar array. Zimmerman said the district will lease the property to Clean Energy, which will build the solar array and charge the district for the energy to offset its costs for the panels. That will result in the district cutting its power bill in half over the next 20 years. The savings, he said, is estimated at $1.1 million over 25 years. Zimmerman said he's happy to know the project has been approved, although the school board still has details to work out with Clean Energy. If we can do anything to save money for our district and ultimately the taxpayers, that's a good thing, he said. Next, all projects approved by the State Power Agency moved to the Illinois Commerce Commission for approval. Starr said the ICC is likely to approve the majority of them. He said his agency tried to be vigilant about making sure the approved projects are far enough along that they will happen, but if they don't, some of the hundreds that are now on a waiting list would get bumped up. Either way, thousands of solar arrays should eventually be built, Starr said. So, it's a major step forward. And another article on page one, headlined Fashionably Late. Bound co-stars Tilly, Gershon try and fail to slip into the opening gala unnoticed by Frank R. Piper. I'm a little giddy this evening, Chaz Ebert admitted to guests at Wednesday's opening gala for the 21st Roger Ebert's Film Festival. I'm giddy because I'm so happy, she explained, noting that it takes a full year to bring the event together, and it's a thrill for her to see it finally all come to fruition. She later asked to have a couple doors opened in the University of Illinois President's House, as she said she was feeling a bit faint having woken up that morning with butterflies. While she attributed her case of jitters partly to her enthusiasm for again playing host to the film festival for her late husband, and partly for her excitement over the evening's scheduled movie at the Virginia Theater, Amazing Grace, featuring a 1972 performance by Aretha Franklin, her giddiness appeared absolutely contagious, especially when her fashionably tardiest but easily most popular guests arrived just as Chaz was winding up her introductory remarks. Actress Jennifer Tilly showed up first, futilely attempting to slip into a front row seat unnoticed. But upon being called up to the podium to be recognized through her fellow guest actress, Gina Gershon, under the bus, blaming her for the lateness of their arrival. Gina said she'd be here in 5 minutes, but that was 20 minutes ago, Tilly told the small crowd. I couldn't wait anymore. I didn't want to miss this. Gershon arrived a few minutes later to a similarly enthusiastic reception, but was perhaps even more excited to spot her cousin, director Alan Elliott, among the VIP guests on hand, calling it a nice surprise. Elliott was presented as the featured special guest for Wednesday night's showing of Amazing Grace, which he co-directed along with producer Tyrell Whiteley, using flawed footage shot by director Sidney Pollack that sat in a vault for 35 years before Elliott rescued it and overcame its sound-syncing glitch. Gershon said she had already seen the documentary three times, yet looked forward to seeing it again. Among the kudos and shout-outs, and expressions of gratitude passed around at the gala, there were a couple of minor disappointments as well, the biggest being that another much-anticipated actress scheduled as a special guest, Virginia Madsen, won't be able to attend, at least in person. As festival director Nate Cohn disclosed earlier in the day on WDWS AM's Penny for Your Thoughts, Madsen was held up by an extended shooting schedule for a TV series she's working on in North Carolina, but she's planning to appear as scheduled for the Q&A session after Saturday night's showing of Sideways, albeit via live satellite feed. Tilly expressed regrets that her and Gershon's co-star in Bound, actor and previous Ebertfest guest, Joe Pantoliano, wasn't able to join them because I just love Joey. And Chaz Ebert noted that Cameron Crowe, director and writer of Almost Famous, had sent along apologies for being unable to accept an invitation to attend, though he filmed a video intro that will be shown before his 2000 film is shown on Saturday afternoon. On the other hand, that might just be good news for Ebert fans, along with word from Cohn that festival passes and tickets to all 13 films on this year's schedule, including a previous unpublicized short film on the bill, Sebastian, slated for 10 a.m. Friday at the Virginia, are still available at the theater's box office and at the festival's website. My favorite fest moments from day one. The belated arrival of actress Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon at Wednesday night's opening gala at the U of I President's House palpably jump-started the 21st Ebertfest's energy level from the moment each tried to enter the room discreetly, as if. Gershon seemed a trifle embarrassed at all the instant attention, but Tilly ate it up, eagerly joining Chaz at the podium and taking over the microphone to offer a warm memory of the festival's Pulitzer Prize-winning namesake, Roger Ebert. Bound was one of those films that sort of came out and everybody was confused, and Roger just got it. I mean, he championed the film, she said. On the other hand, she said, while Ebert was a ferocious lover of film, he was just as quick to tell her that a film she was in that seemed to be well received wasn't such a great film, but I loved Bound. As if she needed any help in winning over Ebertfest fans, Tilly endeared herself even more Wednesday by gushing to Chaz Ebert and her guests. This is an amazing festival. I would love to come sometime and just see all those films. What a great audience you've got. Consider this an open invitation, Jennifer. Among the many special guests Chaz Ebert singled out for recognition and applause at the gala was someone I'd already had the pleasure of meeting a few minutes earlier while eyeing the hors d'oeuvres table. Polish actress Maya Komorowska, who was accompanied by her grandson, Jerzy, spell that, T-Y-S-Z-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z, who was also doubling as her interpreter. Komorowska was in town for Friday's showing of A Year of the Quiet Sun, a 1984 film in which she starred as a Polish refugee opposite frequent Ebertfest guest Scott Wilson, who died last October and is being honored at this year's festival. She and her grandson had flown into Chicago from Warsaw, and he was still marveling at the shortest plane ride I've ever had in the 45-minute shuttle flight from Chicago to Champaign. She seemed more concerned with persuading him to eat something from the hors d'oeuvre table. You know how grandmas are. Looking forward to day two. 9 a.m. today, the panel discussion at Ebertfest, as a rule, gets less publicity than the film screenings, but they have a lot to offer the inquiring cinephile as well, not to mention an intriguing mix of talented critics and media experts. There are two panels scheduled for this year's festival, both of them this morning on the lower level of the Hyatt Place Hotel, 217 North Neal Street in Champaign. Both are free and open to the public, with the first from 9 to 10 a.m., the Alliance for Inclusion and Respect panel moderated by film scholar Eric Pearson on the topic of Challenging Stigma Through the Arts, and the second from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m., the Women in Cinema panel moderated by Chaz Ebert herself and featuring Tilly and Gershon as panelists on Hollywood or Independent, Does It Make a Difference? The best part, for sleepyheads like me, the panel discussion as well as post-screening Q&A sessions are all live-streamed on the festival's website at ebertfest.com and available there anytime thereafter. 4 p.m. today, Paul Wood will be catching the day's films as the silent classic Cœur de Fée, The Faithful Heart, with Alloy Orchestra performing. But I'll be back in the Virginia later in the afternoon for Rachel Got Married with movie executives and media experts Michael Barker and Stephen Apcon as special guests. As I wrote in today's Frank's Faves column, this viewing, like most of the rest on Ebert's schedule, will be a first for me, and I'm especially looking forward to catching Anne Hathaway's Oscar-nominated performance. 9 p.m. today. No question, this will be the high point of the day, especially if special guests Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon are in the house, as scheduled for the screening of their 1996 crime drama, Bound. And from page A4 under Science, an article headlined Black Hole's Appearance Fits Theories, written by Seth Bornstein from the AP Science writer line. Humanity got its first glimpse Wednesday of the cosmic place of no return, a black hole. And it's as hot, as violent, and as beautiful as science fiction imagined. In a breakthrough that thrilled the world of astrophysics and stirred talk of a Nobel Prize, scientists released the first image ever made of a black hole, revealing a fiery donut-shaped object in a galaxy 53 million light-years from Earth. Science fiction has become science fact, University of Waterloo theoretical physicist Avery Broderick, one of the leaders of the research team of about 200 scientists from 20 countries, declared as the colorized orange and black picture was unveiled. The image, assembled from data gathered by 8 radio telescopes around the world, shows light and gas swirling around the lip of a supermassive black hole, a monster of the universe theorized by Einstein more than a century ago and confirmed by observations over the decades. Supermassive black holes are situated at the center of most galaxies, including ours, and are so dense that nothing, not even light, can escape them. Light gets bent and twisted around by gravity in a bizarre funhouse effect as it gets sucked into the abyss along with superheated gas and dust. The new image helps confirm Einstein's general theory of relativity. Einstein even predicted the nearly symmetrical shape that scientists just found. We have seen what we thought was unseeable. We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole, announced Shepard Dolman of Harvard, leader of the project. Jessica Dempsey, another co-discoverer and deputy director of the East Asian Observatory in Hawaii, said the fiery circle reminded her of the flaming eye of Sauron from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. 3 years ago, scientists using an extraordinarily sensitive observing system heard the sound of two much smaller black holes merging to create a gravitational wave, as Einstein predicted. The new image, published in the astrophysical journal Letters and announced around the world, adds light to that sound. Outside scientists suggested the achievement could be worthy of a Nobel, just like the gravitational wave discovery. I think it looks very convincing, said Andrea Goetz, director of the UCLA Galactic Center Group, who wasn't part of this discovery team. The picture was made with equipment that detects wavelength invisible to the human eye, so astronomers added color to convey the ferocious heat of the gas and dust, glowing at a temperature of perhaps millions of degrees. But if a person were to somehow get close to this black hole, it might not look quite like that, astronomers said. The black hole is about 6 billion times the mass of our sun and is in a galaxy called M87. Its event horizon, the precipice or point of no return, where light and matter get sucked inexorably into the hole, is as big as our entire solar system. Black holes are the most extreme environment in the known universe, Broderick said, a violent, churning place of gravity run amok. Unlike smaller black holes, which come from collapsed stars, supermassive black holes are mysterious in origin. Despite decades of study, there are a few people who deny black holes exist, and this work shows that they do, said Boston University astronomer professor Alan Marcher as co-discoverer. The project costs $50 million to $60 million, with $28 million of that coming from National Science Foundation. The same team has gathered even more data on black holes in the middle of our own Milky Way galaxy, but scientists say the object is so jumpy they don't have a good picture yet. Myth says that a black hole would rip you apart, but scientists say that because of the particular forces exerted by an object as big as the one in M87, someone could fall into it and not be torn to pieces, but the person would never be heard from or seen again. Black holes are like the walls of a prison. Once you cross it, you'll never be able to get out, and you will never be able to communicate, said astronomer Avi Loeb, director of the Black Hole Initiative at Harvard, who was not involved in the discovery. The telescope data was gathered 2 years ago over 4 days when the weather had to be just right all around the world. Completing the image was an enormous undertaking involving an international team of scientists, supercomputers, and hundreds of terabytes of data. When scientists initially put all that data into the first picture, what they saw looked so much like what they expected they didn't believe it at first. We've been hunting this for a long time, Dempsey said. We've been getting closer and closer with better technology. In a related article, with the headline, U of I Team Played a Major Role. The Worldwide Event Horizon Telescope project has captured its first ever image of a black hole at the center of a giant galaxy in the constellation Virgo, 55 million miles away. University of Illinois Physics and Astronomy Professor Charles Gamme led the theory working group for the scientific collaboration. His team, which included U of I graduate students Ben Prather and Charles Wong, helped interpret the data that produced the historic image. It also enabled scientists to determine the mass of the massive black hole, 6 billion of our suns, and shed new light on its mysterious plasma jets. Julie Wirth spoke to Gamme, who was in Washington, D.C. for Wednesday's announcement. What was it like to see the actual image after all of your theoretical work? It was fabulous, very gratifying, and actually a little surprising that it looks so much like what we had all predicted. It's something we've been working on at Illinois for more than 15 years, aspects of this and really intensively over the last year. My students haven't slept in 6 months, and neither have I. How long did your part of the project take? The data was gathered in April 2017. It was then shipped back to two centers, one at MIT Haystack Observatory and one in Bonn, Germany, for first analysis. What we did at the end was help interpret the data. We built theoretical models of what you see in the image that involves big supercomputing simulations. U of I has long been a leader in this business. NCSA was founded by a guy who was working on a very similar problem, Larry Smarr. He had a graduate student who was my postdoc's advisor many years later. They went to Germany to work on his student's thesis and found a supercomputer they could work on. They realized it was really great and they needed one. Why is this milestone so significant? It does cast Einstein's theory of gravity in a new regime, but it's also interesting for understanding how black holes work out in nature, sort of far away from the theorist's chalkboard. There they sit, these messy environments, which are the centers of galaxies. There are all kinds of weird stars and gases around. Oftentimes, they produce powerful jets of gas that emerge from the centers of the galaxies. That's what we see in Messier 87, the system we studied. That thing has two jets of gas that come out of the middle of the galaxy. It's long been a mystery what powers those jets. I think that our theoretical analysis strongly suggests that the jets are powered by the black hole itself, by the rotation of the black hole. The magnetic fields near the black hole break or slow the rotation of the black hole, transforming its rotational energy to the surrounding hot gas, which in turn forms the jets. No light can escape from a black hole, so what's the glowing ring around the black hole in the image? It's the event horizon, the point of no return. The glowing stuff comes from gas falling into the black hole. The stuff that's falling in gets really, really hot to temperatures of a billion or more degrees, so it glows. Is what we see the actual size? The gravity of the black hole bends the light around it. So when this gas that's falling in produces light, that light gets bent. The net effect of that is to really emphasize the brightness of the ring around the hole. It makes the ring brighter. The black hole looks bigger in the sky because of gravitational lensing. It's about five times bigger than the actual size. The black hole is still bigger than our entire solar system. You've said scientists hope to add radio telescopes to the Event Horizon Network and eventually put in some space to get some higher quality images. How would that work and how far away is that? By using telescopes all over the Earth, you're getting as fine a resolution as if you had a telescope the size of the Earth. If you made it bigger, you get even finer resolution. So if you put something in space, you get finer resolution. I thought it was about 10 years away, but I talked to an engineer who's working on it today, and she told me it was only 5 years away, which would be amazing if true. But any space mission is expensive. It would mean at least hundreds of millions of dollars. There are at least two proposals that I know of, one from Europe and one from the United States. The way these things usually work, at the end there's some collaboration and there's one mission that flies. And from Section B of the News Gazette, an article on Kenny Chesney's concert requests. Headlined, Chesney's Request, Masseuse, No Sand. The contract and rider for country star Kenny Chesney's concert Friday at State Farm Center doesn't contain any of the bizarre requests some musicians make to ensure the venue is paying attention. Think the Foo Fighters, who prohibited fans from bringing bootleg Swedish fish to their show here in November. But Chesney's rider, obtained by the News Gazette Media through an open records request, still included some interesting requests. A masseuse room and access to a local gym or on-site workout room. State Farm Center Director Kevin Ulstead said masseuse requests aren't uncommon. It's a lot of people on the road. I think this one was an 18-truck show, he said. This was a huge show, and some of the touring crew or even the band members want a massage. He noted they still had to pay for them. A room called Bobby's Lowdown Clown Room, Ulstead described it, and Chesney's Vibe Room as basically just his party room where his VIPs hang out backstage without getting in the band's way. 30 dozen towels that are big man-sized and of a good thick quality, at least when he performs at amphitheaters. So this wasn't an issue at Friday's show. We bring our own towels, said Ryan Plagman with the Messina Touring Group, which handles Chesney's songs for the Saints tour. And the sandbar, the fan section closest to the stage, which isn't actually a sandbar. There is no sand, the writer said. Ulstead said the show nearly sold out the 10,500 tickets available. About 400 showed up to the pre-show party on an upper concourse. The show itself was incredible, he said. It's one we've been working on for a good 2 or 3 years, he said. We had him 3 years in a row. 2003, 4, 5, and then he went on to the majority of his touring in the summer in amphitheaters and stadiums. To learn more, go to the article in full at thenewsgazette.com. Article was written by Ben Zeiderman. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette from Thursday, April 11th. Please stay tuned.